This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Iranian president meets with the Algerian foreign minister, saying Tehran and Algiers can expand relations in various fields. Israeli protesters take to the streets for a 27th consecutive week as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu renews his attempt to overhaul the regime's judicial system. Despite opposition from its allies, the U.S. says it will supply Ukraine with internationally banned cluster munitions as Russia calls the move an act of desperation. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has called for an expansion of ties with Algeria during a meeting with the Arab country's foreign minister in Tehran. Raisi said two countries can develop ties in different trade and economic areas. He voiced Iran's willingness to share scientific and technological achievements with Algiers. He also called for more unity between the Islamic states regarding the issue of Palestine. Ahmed Attaf, for his part, said Algiers is ready to expand relations with Iran at the highest possible level. Attaf also called for an increase in economic and trade cooperation between the two nations. Mourners hold a funeral for a 24-year-old Palestinian man killed Friday during a demonstration against Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. Young man identified as Abdul-Jawad Hamdan Saleh was killed in the village of Safa near Ramallah. The village has been seen of attacks by settlers as of late. Israeli forces also killed two other Palestinians during a raid on Nablus Friday. Israel's intensified its deadly crackdown across occupied territories. Just days ago, the regime launched a deadly offensive in Jenin, killing a dozen Palestinians and injuring scores more. And now a European envoy visiting the camp has slammed Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories and said cycle of violence has to come to an end.
It has to end. It cannot continue. If there is no political solution to the conflict, we are going to stand here in a week's time, in a month's time, in a year's time, with nothing changed. It requires from all duty bearers resolve and foresight and action to end the cycle of violence, to end the occupation, to find a political perspective for the Palestinians and for the PA to be able to govern effectively in the West Bank and in Gaza through elections, through unity, through effective and countable governance. And we, the Dashi community, have an obligation politically, morally, and financially to support all this.
Bergsdorf made his comments as he led a delegation of UN officials and diplomats from 25 countries through the camp. He also blasted the regime for using disproportionate force against Palestinians. He called on Israel to refrain from measures that will harm civilians and to have more respect for international law. His remarks were echoed by the UN chief, Antonio Guterres, who on Thursday told reporters there is an excessive force used by the Israeli forces in the operation. Welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Tel Aviv has seen the biggest protests in weeks against a renewed push by Premier Benjamin Netanyahu's hard-right coalition to overhaul the judicial system. Tens of thousands demonstrated in several cities, with the rally in Tel Aviv drawing up to 150,000 protesters. Security forces used water cannon to disperse some demonstrators who were blocking a main highway. Israelis have been protesting for 27 consecutive weeks since January, when the cabinet announced a plan to overhaul the judiciary. Feeling the pressure, Netanyahu then announced a pause in the controversial reforms and called for negotiations with the opposition. Those talks, however, proved unsuccessful, and the prime minister has now taken the offensive once again to drive through his reforms. The legislation package will roll back some of the Supreme Court's powers and give the ruling coalition decisive sway over picking judges. Parliament is expected to hold its first of three votes on the new bill Monday, protest leaders have said they plan to intensify the demonstrations, with a day of protests expected for Tuesday. Joining us now for the program is Mr. Bruce Katz, co-president at Palestinian and Jewish Unity, joining us from Montreal, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in Kitchener with you, Robert. Hope you're safe and doing well. Your initial thoughts on how many protests we've seen against this and why it's still on the table?
It's amazing that there's been this level of protest for several months now. Hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets, blocking traffic, attempting to disrupt the normal flow of business in order to show their displeasure with this judicial overhaul, so-called overhaul, that Netanyahu is proposing. The reason it's still on the table is because Netanyahu wants to have, there are a couple of reasons. One, he wants to have this power. He wants to be an absolute dictator to run things as he chooses. Secondly, he is, of course, under indictment. And by revamping the judicial system, he can basically make that any indictments or convictions meaningless. And third, he wants to stay in power. And if he retracts on this commitment to make this judicial overhaul, then he will lose some of his so-called coalition partners, some of the extreme right-wing, extreme racist members of his cabinet and his government that he needs in order to maintain the government. So he's in a difficult situation that he's put himself in. He has no one to blame but himself. And this is why we're seeing these continued protests among the Israelis. Now, we should add that the Israeli people are certainly right and justified in protesting this, but there are more very serious issues that have been ongoing with the government that they should be protesting, and that's the apartheid regime and the treatment of the Palestinians.
Thank you there, Robert. And Bruce Katz, welcome to the program. Now, Bruce, when you see numbers in small occupied land, when you have people over 100,000 plus coming out to protest, that's a significant portion of the population. With this much blowback, why do you think that this extreme right cabinet feels so, and Benjamin Netanyahu, feel imperative to push through this reform package?
Well, I think the gentleman just spoke in certainly made a reference to one of the reasons, that is that this is the way that Netanyahu stays out of prison. He desperately wants to get rid of the indictment, and basically this would put him in the position of being an outright dictator. I think it also points to the fact that it's Ben-Gvir and Smotrich that really are running the country. If we want to talk about a type of vaudeville act, he's the straight man who delivers the lines. But the real power behind the throne, I think, are Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. Now, the basically tens of thousands of Israelis who are protesting points to the degree to which Israel is a polarized society. It also, I think, points to the reality of an extreme right government that at some point, and I don't think it'll take that long, is going to collapse. But I think there's something that's very significant that needs to be stated, and that is that of the tens of thousands of Israelis that are protesting, there are no Palestinians. So basically you have Israelis who are there to support the principle of a Jewish democracy and a court system and a Supreme Court which has consistently ruled in favor of Jewish exclusivism. For example, the nation state, which states categorically that only Jews in Israel have civil rights. Even Palestinians living within Israel are at best second-class citizens. We see the ethnic cleansing going on in East Jerusalem, where Palestinians are being driven out of their homes systematically. So when we talk about judicial overhaul, it's a judicial overhaul which has no impact whatsoever on the Palestinians. They live under military dictatorship in an apartheid state. So, you know, that explains the reason why Palestinians who are entirely disenfranchised are not there. It's not for their it's not in their interests.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us for the program. Stay safe to both of you there. Bruce Katz joining us from Montreal, Mr. Robert Fantina joining us out of Kitchener, Ontario. That brings us to the end of this segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. The UK says it will not provide internationally banned cluster munitions to Ukraine in its war with Russia.
Well, the UK is signatory to a convention which prohibits the production or use of cluster munitions and discourages their use. We will continue to do our part to support Ukraine against Russia's illegal and unprovoked invasion. We've done
that recently. Sunak made the comments in an address to reporters. Spain has also followed suit, saying certain weapons and bombs cannot be delivered under any circumstances. Germany has also opposed sending cluster munitions as well. Now, on Friday, the U.S. said it will send Ukraine the widely banned weapons to help it in its counteroffensive against Russia. It says Kiev has provided written assurances that weapons will be used carefully to minimize a risk to civilians. Russia has slammed the move, saying decision is an act of desperation which displays weakness. Cluster munitions are banned by over 100 countries.
The U.S. has made a decision that it will send Ukraine the deadly cluster munitions. The U.S. went on a media blitz to make its case that its decision was justified. From the White House to the Pentagon,
I'm as concerned about the humanitarian circumstance as anybody. But the worst thing for civilians in Ukraine is for Russia to win the war.
To Jake Sullivan, President Joe Biden's national security advisor.
And I'm not going to stand up here and say it is easy. It's a difficult decision. It's a decision we deferred. It's a decision that required a real hard look at the potential harm to civilians.
But are there any doubts about why cluster munitions should not be used and why they are deadly? Cluster bombs carry several hundred bomblets or cluster munitions. Dropped by aircraft or launched from the ground, they're designed to be dispersed over a wide area, which can cover the size of several soccer fields. As they are free-falling, they can strike the ground at a considerable distance from the target area if they are not used correctly. And what makes cluster munitions so controversial is their impact on civilian populations. According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, up to 40% of cluster bombs result in unexploded rounds or duds, which can cause civilian deaths long after a conflict is over. The Convention on Cluster Munitions is a convention banning the use of cluster bombs and has been joined by more than 120 countries. The U.S., however, is not a signatory to this convention, even though it is a member of the Organization on the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW. Decades after the conflict, they continue to kill. According to the group Handicap International, 98% of cluster bomb victims are civilians, and 27% are children. When the U.S. president was asked why he was providing the cluster munitions now, part of an $800 million security package, he said it was because Ukraine had run out of ammunition.
Mr. President, cluster munitions, why now?
We've run out of ammunition.
The Secretary General supports the Convention on Cluster Munitions, which, as you know, was adopted 15 years ago. And he wants countries to abide by the terms of that convention. And so, as a result, of course, he does not want there to be continued use of cluster munitions on the battlefield.
U.S. has been known to use outlawed ammunition in many different wars, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Yemen. U.S. has been either directly involved in or provided warring parties with deadly ammunition. This is against international law, especially when it comes to export of the deadly munitions to other countries, like Ukraine in this case.
The U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen, officially still not over. It has resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands. Some of those killed, which were mainly women and children, were a result of cluster munitions, courtesy of the U.S. Yet, the U.S. use of cluster munitions have not been restricted to Yemen. The U.S. initially used cluster bombs during the invasion of Afghanistan that began in 2001. The U.S. dropped more than 1,500 cluster bombs in that country during the first 3 years of the occupation. It is very telling that not only did the U.S. not have any regard for using these outlawed bombs, but the amount used showed complete disregard for human lives, particularly for women and children, who are still being murdered to this day. And it doesn't end there. The Biden administration has also agreed to provide Ukraine with depleted uranium shells to equip Abrams tanks that the U.S. is sending there. Britain has already delivered these tanks to Ukraine, equipped with depleted uranium shells. DU munitions developed in the 1970s are not nuclear weapons and do not produce a nuclear explosion, but soldiers or civilians can be exposed to the uranium either in combat or afterward. This was particularly the case in Iraq, when during the U.S. 2003 invasion, heavy use of depleted uranium caused many to die and suffer to this day of diseases which have led to things like birth defects. Instead of searching for a political solution, U.S. and U.K. governments clearly believe that providing DU munitions will improve Ukraine's ability to defeat Russian tanks and bring this conflict to an end. What is even more telling is that the U.S. has said that Ukraine has run out of ammo, in particular the 155mm howitzer, putting into question Ukraine's ability to continue this war. The 155mm howitzer round is one of the most requested artillery munitions of the Ukraine war. The U.S. has already shipped more than 1.5 million rounds to Ukraine, but Kiev is still seeking more. Even though both Russia and Ukraine have been accused of using cluster munitions, which have killed civilians on both sides, the Russian ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, criticized the transfer of these weapons to Ukraine by the U.S. The cruelty and cynicism with which Washington has approached the issue of transferring lethal weapons to Kiev is striking. Now, by the fault of the U.S., there will be a risk for many years that innocent civilians will be blown up by submunitions that have failed. Do these civilians deserve this fate due to the U.S. desire to weaken Russia, the purported aim of the U.S. supporting Ukraine in this war?
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
According to Russian President Vladimir Putin, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, is tackling multiple global issues, including the degradation of international security system, the rising risk of a new economic and financial crisis, and the hostile West pressures and sanctions against independent countries. Russian President Vladimir Putin said, "The fact that other nations pursue friendly relations with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization by applying to join it proves this." We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Russia Today has covered this story and tells us more. Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Tuesday, 4th of July, at a high-profile international meeting that Russia is being targeted by foreign nations that have groomed a hostile neighbor at its doorstep, then imposed Moscow with unprecedented economic sanctions. But he assured an audience of government officials his country is successfully withstanding the pressure. The Russian leader explained, "For a very long time, foreign forces implemented projects on our border, which turned our neighbor Ukraine into a de facto hostile nation, an anti-Russian nation. They pumped it with weapons for 8 years, turned a blind eye to the aggression against civilians in Donbass, and fostered a neo-Nazi ideology." He added, "Now the same players have bundled an unprecedented number of illegal unilateral economic sanctions on Russia. The goal of this hybrid warfare is to weaken the country economically in addition to threatening its security." He said, "Russia confidently withstands and will continue to withstand foreign pressure, sanctions and provocations. In these circumstances, our nation keeps developing steadily." President Putin was speaking during a virtual meeting of the leaders of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, a Eurasian Economic and Security Forum, of which Russia is a founding member. President Putin said the SCO is tackling multiple global issues, including the degradation of the international security system, the rising risk of a new economic and financial crisis amid the unchecked accumulation of debt by developed nations, social fracturing and growth of poverty, and the worsening food and environmental security. He welcomed the bloc's growing influence in global affairs and reputation within the world community. President Putin said, "The fact that other nations pursue friendly relations with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, by applying to join it, proves this." The Islamic Republic of Iran has become the 9th full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. President Putin accused wealthy countries of implementing years of irresponsible budgetary and monetary policies, which eventually triggered the current debt crisis. According to the International Monetary Fund's executive director for Russia, Alexei Mushkin, Britain and almost all EU countries are facing significant levels of debt. This includes France, Spain, Portugal, Greece and Italy. Alexei Mushkin also said that Russia-China trade and economic cooperation is expanding, with over 80% of settlements between the two nations currently made in Russian rubles and Chinese yuan. According to President Putin, the volume of trade between Russia and fellow SCO member states reached a record $263 billion in 2022. He noted the figure was up 35% in the first 4 months of this year. President Putin said the share of the ruble in Russia's settlements with the SCO member states exceeded 40%. Trade between Russia and China has continued to accelerate after hitting a historic high of $190.3 billion in annual terms in 2022. Exports and imports have surged at double-digit pace since the beginning of the year. According to customs data, bilateral trade soared to $93.8 billion in the period from January till May of this year, marking a 40.7% increase compared to a year ago. Russia's finance minister, Anton Siluanov, recently said that bilateral trade is on track to surpass the target of $200 billion a year earlier than anticipated. Economic ties have been bolstered by the mutual decision to conduct the majority of transactions in national currencies instead of US dollars. The website of Press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, has officially approved Iran's fully-fledged membership in the world's largest regional organization in terms of geographic scope and population. The Islamic Republic of Iran became a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization during the 23rd virtual summit of the bloc, which started on Tuesday, 4th of July, with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi as its chairperson. Iran first applied for membership of the organization 15 years ago, but it took until 2021 for the request to be approved. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which has its headquarters in China, is a diplomatic organization with 8 members, namely Russia, India, Pakistan, the Central Asian countries of Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. The Islamic Republic of Iran and the organization started a formal process for Tehran's accession to the bloc in March of 2022. In September of the same year, Iran signed a memorandum of commitment to join the SCO. A month later, the Iranian parliament approved the country's accession to the organization. Iranian President Said Ebrahim Raisi has warned against the dominance of the dollar in global trade, saying de-dollarization is a pivotal necessity to form a just international trading system. Iranian President Said Ebrahim Raisi made the remark in an address to the 23rd virtual summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, after Iran gained its full membership in the bloc. He said cooperation among SCO member states in the economic field can open a clear vision of a just regional order to the eyes of the world nations. President Raisi said, based on past decades' experience, militarism and the dominance of the dollar from the bases of Western dominating system, President Raisi pointed out, any attempt to shape a fair international system requires the removal of this instrument of dominance in intra-regional relations. He noted that civilization is the greatest capacity of SCO member countries to build unity and peace. President Raisi stressed the importance of promoting a civilization in this ancient continent based on ethics, spirituality, justice, rationality, and respect for human dignity. Furthermore, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says he is confident that Iran's membership within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization will provide the SCO with a growing capacity. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a recent phone conversation with the Secretary General of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Zhang Ming. He said the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, and the Iranian government, particularly the foreign ministry, have made substantial efforts to prepare and approve all the documents relating to the country's full membership of the SCO. The Iranian foreign minister hailed efforts and cooperation by SCO Secretary General to complete the process of full membership. For his part, the Secretary General of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Zhang Ming, said Iran plays a leading role in promoting SCO objectives. An Iranian political analyst says Iran's accession to the SCO will help promote security and prosperity in Asia and counter Western hegemony. The Iranian political expert, Mohammad Marandi, a professor at Tehran University, said, "It is an important moment in contemporary history with all the changes taking place, the decline of the West, the multiple wars that we're seeing and rising tensions in East Asia, and of course the atrocities that we continue to see in occupied Palestine." Mohammad Marandi added, "While this is happening, the economy is moving away from the West. The global economy, the center of economy and commerce and trade and production is moving to Asia, and Iran is very much part of this." He added, "The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, offers such a platform, enabling enhanced security, prosperity, and shielding Asian countries from imposition of Western agendas."
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means to...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though, we learn...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip, what role does contemplation play when it comes to increasing, strengthening, and leveling up our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to Allah? So, dear listeners, it's great to be here with you, talking about ubudiyah. So, in today's program, we really want to talk about what role contemplation plays when it comes to increasing, strengthening, and leveling up our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. Now, you know, as you know, and as we all know, we live in a very fast-paced world. Technological advancement, scientific advancement, seems like everything has become mechanized, everything is mechanical, we are surrounded by machines. And what's interesting is machines themselves don't really have souls or spirits. And so this being surrounded by objects which don't have a soul or a spirit, these things have a sort of an impact and an effect on us. I dare say that it, you know, being surrounded by these spiritless objects kind of makes us move in the same direction. Over the passing of time and days and months and years, it slowly starts to turn us into a machine. Even though it's kind of a side note and a tangent, but it's not bad to talk about, I think, because it does have an effect on our ubudiyah. And that is the role of social media and the electronic devices that we use. And these things do have an effect on our ubudiyah. And I think it's appropriate that we will, inshallah, talk about this on a different program. But kind of coming back so that we don't digress, we live in this age where, yes, we are surrounded by spiritless objects, and this does have an effect on us. Now, one of the attributes or one of the qualities of this world that we live in, as we said, is this fast-paced, you know, it's almost like a blur. You wake up and all of a sudden you are much older, right? You're in your 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s. Or maybe even in your 70s, and life has passed by, and where did it go? I don't know, right? And this is a phenomenon that happens to probably every single one of us at one point or another in our life. Now, one of the things in order to be able to slow down this, you know, dizzying pace of the world is contemplation. This idea of reflection, of contemplation, of thinking, of thought, of bringing a sort of a peace of mind and tranquility to the mind and to the spirit. So it's kind of like you're running, you know, every single day and day in and day out in this, you know, quote unquote rat race, which is promoted by Western civilization and free market, capitalism and liberalism and I don't know, all these other man-made systems which has destroyed the spirit and the essence of humanity. We don't have time to stop and really find that peace of mind and that tranquility. And so contemplation will give us that time to slow down, to have this peace of mind, you know, and to really be able to focus on those things that are important. The connection of contemplation with ubudiya, we will talk about in the next segment.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنير طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير يا الله يا رحمن حقق أمانينا.
And now we will listen to Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami, who will talk about today's topic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. As we said in Surah Taha, verse number 14, Innani ana Allah, la ilaha illa ana fa'budni wa aqim as-salata li dhikri. The second part of the verse where Almighty God says, fa'budni, worship me. We believe that God is one. We acknowledge, as Muslims, the monotheistic belief in Almighty God, His uniqueness, and all of the other attributes that come along with Tawheed. It's very important for us to know the different levels of Tawheed. But now I want to act upon this belief. I have faith in the Almighty, and now I wish to see the results and the fruits of this Tawheed. And I can do that by worshipping, by expressing my devout devotion to the Almighty. I wish to show that I have submitted and done my taslim to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Yes, ta'a and obedience is one thing, but ibadah and worship is something else. Innani ana Allah la ilaha illa ana. Fa'budni. Again, the whole message of our Anbiya, all of them, was to bring about people to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to worship Him. The reason why we were created was to worship the Almighty. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
شربنا على فكري
حبيبي مدامتا
ساكرنا بها من قال
لأن يخلق الكرم.
IRIB English Radio.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In continuation to what we were talking about, if you remember, we were talking about how contemplation and reflection plays a role in our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. And the previous segment, of course, we had been talking a little bit about how we live in a very fast-paced, dizzying world, and many times we don't have the opportunity to be able to think about ourselves, to be able to think about our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. We are so caught up in everything that we're doing that, you know, we're not able to focus on the things that we need to. First and foremost, our relationship with the Almighty Allah, which, of course, is done via ubudiyah. It is done via our service, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. So in this segment, we really wanted to talk about now this connection between contemplation and ubudiyya. Really, a lot of these subjects are vast subjects, which you can really talk about, you know, for a long time. Unfortunately, due to a lack of time, you know, we have to kind of condense these subject matters as the time allows. But contemplation, of course, you know, it has different aspects. You know, there are different things that it is encouraged to reflect and think about. So, of course, we have a lot of traditions, you know, from the Immaculate and Infallible Imams, peace be upon them, as well as the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, where they talk about how contemplation, 1 hour's contemplation, is better than, for example, 70 hours of worship. Or in other places, 1 hour's contemplation is better than 70 nights of worship. Or in another place, 70 years of worship, or, you know, and so on and so forth, you know. And it seems like every tradition just keeps on increasing the value of that contemplation. In another program, inshallah, we'll talk about what we need to contemplate over, because there's various things that one should contemplate over. But just so that we don't leave a cliffhanger, in this program, one of the things that we need to contemplate over, you know, is, for example, the ubudiyya that we have and the relationship we have with the Almighty Allah. Now, this is one of the probably most important things that we should contemplate over. And like I said, because our relationship with the Almighty Allah, our relationship with our Creator, our relationship with the one who has given us existence, it's self-explanatory now after describing it in this manner, that is the most important relationship that we have. You know, as the Holy Quran says, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un," that from Allah have we come, and it is to Allah that we will return. And so how sad and unfortunate and truly disastrous would it be that from where we came from and to whom we shall return and we shall be presented, we don't have a good relationship. And so contemplating upon our relationship, taking time out, whether it is 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 1 hour, you know, at any given point in time of the day. But again, as we have said in all of our programs, slow and steady. At first, just give yourself 10 minutes, you know, and on a specific time, every other day, right? Every third day, put it down on your calendar, you know, for example, on Friday, you know, before I go to sleep, 10 minutes, I'm just going to think about my relationship with the Almighty Allah. Right? I'm going to contemplate, I'm going to reflect, you know? And of course, there's many questions that come out of this. Well, what kind of relationship do I have with the Almighty Allah? What kind of relationship should I have? What is the current state of my relationship with the Almighty Allah? You know, and then you bring in, and this is ubudiyya. This is a informal type of ubudiyya. Like we said, we have explained formal ubudiyya and informal ubudiyya in many of our programs, which you should check out to fully understand what we're talking about. But this is informal ubudiyya, contemplating for 10 minutes before you go to sleep on a specific day. Now, the reason that we want to do a specific day and a specific time and for a specific time, at a specific time, is so that we bring consistency. Right? Another one of the things that we've talked about is spiritual development that is really fast but does not last is not as useful, and it is not as beneficial and effectful as spiritual development that is slow but is constant. And it is that constancy that we are really striving for. And yes, eventually that constancy will turn that slow into fast, right? So you think about this, you contemplate, you reflect, you know, and then what this does, it establishes a relationship, it takes you out of this quote-unquote rat race, which we talked about, and most surely with the grace and the permission of the Almighty Allah, you will be able to increase, enhance, strengthen, and level up your ubudiyya, your service, your worship, and your obedience to the Almighty Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. لا إله سواه لا تخالطه الظنون ولا العيون تراه الله جل في علاه هو أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحماه حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The Limelight.
In Britain, MPs in the House of Commons have said the public health service is getting worse day by day, and they have also warned about a tidal wave of child mental ill health in Britain. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. UK ministers have been charged with failing to grasp the tidal wave of mental ill health blighting children's lives after research found that only a quarter of English primaries will be able to offer vital school-based support by the end of next year, with almost one in five pupils aged between 7 and 16 now thought to have a mental health disorder. Specialist support teams were set up to work with children in schools, addressing early symptoms and reducing pressure on overstretched NHS services. According to new figures shared exclusively with The Guardian, pupils in almost three-quarters of primary schools in England will have had no access to the new mental health support teams by the end of 2024. According to figures obtained by the Liberal Democrats, older pupils fare slightly better, with the mental health support teams expected to be in place in about half of secondary schools by the end of 2024. The government is yet to confirm future funding plans. The research follows reports that a quarter of a million children in the United Kingdom with mental health problems have been denied help by the NHS, with some trusts failing to offer treatment to 60% of those referred by GPs. The former Children's Commissioner for England, Anne Longford, said, "These shocking figures show the scale of the crisis in unmet mental health need that our children are now facing." And Longfield added, "Poor mental health, self-harm and in some cases suicide have become part and parcel of growing up for many children, yet children's mental health services are unable to meet the overwhelming demand." Mental health support teams were widely welcomed when first announced by the government back in 2018, promising early intervention in a school-based setting for children aged between 5 and 18, with mild to moderate mental health problems before they develop into a crisis. School leaders say the mental health support teams are having a positive effect, but the rollout has not gone fast enough or far enough, leaving tens of thousands of children without adequate support either in school or from child and adolescent mental health services. There are also concerns that the teams are struggling to meet the needs of children with more complex conditions, who do not reach the high threshold set for a child and adolescent mental health service referral, but need more support than the mental health support teams can offer. The Liberal Democrats sent freedom of information requests to every NHS integrated care board in England, asking for details about the mental health support teams already operating in their area or due to be operational by the end of 2024. 31 of the 42 integrated care boards responded with data. The responses revealed a huge postcode lottery in the rollout and wide geographical variation in spending per pupil on the mental health support teams, ranging from £87 in the area covered by NHS Surrey Heartlands Integrated Care Board down to £24 in North East and North Cumbria Integrated Care Board and £34 in Hertfordshire and West Essex. The Liberal Democrats' education spokesperson, Munira Wilson, said, "The government is letting down our children and young people. Our children's mental health services were in crisis before the pandemic, but Conservative ministers have failed completely to grasp the scale of the tidal wave in mental ill health that has emerged since." Munira Wilson added, "Under the Tories, a school that sees an NHS mental health professional for a day a week is one of the lucky ones. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of children are left waiting to see if mental health support will be rolled out at their school or sacrificed to pay for the government's economic incompetence. Yet failing to roll out the programme will simply make waiting times for acute child and adolescent mental health services even worse." Website Noledia has also covered the same story and tells us more. The UK's Liberal Democrats' data shows in some areas mental health support teams do not cover secondary schools at all. Data for Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly shows that the mental health support teams cover only primary schools, with a remit to prioritise pupils in reception year and in the transition into year 7. But even then, only 47% of primary schools in the area are covered. Surrey Heartlands Integrated Care Board, which covers most of the country, operates the mental health services team in 4 out of 10 secondary schools, but in fewer than 1 in 10 primary schools. 4 more mental health services teams are due to become operational by the end of next year. The Liberal Democrats say Buckinghamshire, Oxfordshire and West Berkshire Integrated Care Board have seen the slowest rollouts, with existing or planned teams covering just 1 in 5 secondary schools and 1 in 10 primary schools. According to the government, the rollout of the mental health support teams is ahead of schedule, and it has promised to increase the number from nearly 400 in April of 2023, covering 35% of pupils and learners in England, to more than 500, covering about 44% by the same time next year. Barnardo's, which delivers 12 mental health support teams across England, launched a petition earlier this year calling on the government to roll out mental health support teams to cover every school and college throughout England. The charity's senior policy advisor, Becky Rice, said, "Children of all ages across both primary and secondary schools are struggling with their mental health. It is not just something which is impacting those in their teenage years." Becky Rice added, "We need to ensure children of all ages struggling with issues such as low mood, anxiety or emotional regulation get the help and support to manage, so they are able to happily progress through the rest of their childhood years without reaching a crisis point. Schools are dealing with growing numbers of children with special educational needs." Government data published recently showed that the number of children with education, health and care plans in 2023 rose to 517,000, 9% more than last year. Margaret Mulholland, a special needs and inclusion specialist at the Association of College and School and College Leaders, said, "There is a growing mental health crisis among children and young people in England. Mental health support teams can have a really positive impact in tackling this, but not all schools are currently able to access these services. The scheme must be rolled out to all parts of the country as soon as possible to ensure that all children and all young people are able to benefit from it." A government spokesperson claimed, "These teams represent just one of the ways we're supporting school children's mental health and come on top of our annual £2.3 billion investment into mental health services. This means an additional 345,000 children and young people will be able to access the NHS-funded mental health support that they need."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.